Okay, let's get started here with the Dharma talk. So some of you know, and some of you don't know, that our yearly teaching focus for this year is Transcendental Dependent Arising, which is a big fancy way of saying you make a choice. And then one thing leads to the next thing. In other words, everything that happens is dependent on what came before. And there are actually two lists of dependent arising. One is called mundane dependent arising, and that is basically the circle of samsara. That's ignorance to suffering, and you just keep going around and around and around. But sometimes, some people, at some point, if you're ready, you are at the suffering stage and you make a different choice. You take a leap of faith. You decide somehow that there must be a better way. And then you are suddenly on the path of transcendental dependent arising. And faith is that first step. It's like the linchpin. So our month's focus is faith this month. And I know that a lot of people have very negative reactions to the word faith, probably because of being raised in Orthodox religions. But I would like to reclaim that word. I think it's a beautiful word. And I also was raised in one of those traditions. I was raised in the Presbyterian Church. And yes, there was a doctrine that we were expected to believe without any evidence. And we were expected not to ask too many questions. But I did ask questions. And as I expect many of you did, the first question I remember asking. I was in elementary school. I was at Sunday school, and the teacher was talking about heaven and hell and how to get into the first one and avoid the second one. And I asked, "Can my dog go to heaven?" And she said, "Oh no, heaven's not for dogs. Heaven is only for people." And I said, "But she's a good dog, why would they send her to hell?" "Well, no, hell isn't for dogs either. Hell's also for people." And she didn't seem to be quite sure where dogs went. But I do remember that being my first wavering in my faith because I wasn't sure I really wanted a heaven that excluded my dog, right? But of course, I was a kid, so, I stayed in the church. And when I was a teenager, it was time to join the church. So I went to communicants class where I learned all the doctrine, and then we had this ceremony at one of the Sunday morning services. And I remember we recited the Apostles' Creed, which was all the things we were supposed to believe in, like the Trinity and the virgin birth and the resurrection, all of it. And I can remember kind of wondering, do I really believe that? But again, I didn't rock the boat. But when I was in college and not at home anymore, I started thinking about this whole hell and heaven thing. And that was what broke me. Because I was thinking, okay, so there's this baby that is born in Asia or Africa or something into a completely different faith. And they grow up to be a nice person. And then they die and they're sent to hell? No, I don't buy it. I don't buy it. And that was it for the Presbyterian Church and me. And I even convinced my sister that this didn't work. So then for quite a few years, many years, I had really no spiritual path, although I always had these inclinations. And then finally in 1990, when I moved to Montreal, I started meditating with this group called Surat Shabd Yoga. And this is actually where I met my friends who, this family that basically adopted me and I lived on their property and everything. But I, at first, I was really gung-ho, right? And I meditated 3 hours a day. That's what we were supposed to do. Most people didn't, but I did. I listened to, there was this master, and I watched the videos of the master. I even went to London to see the master in person. But gradually, my friends and I began to feel like it was too exclusive. It was like, we have the way, nobody else has it. We weren't even supposed to meditate with people who meditated differently. And we began to feel that this was more of a personality cult than anything, and we gradually drifted away from it. And indeed, we did find out later that there had been physical abuse by the master in his ashram in India. So fortunately, at the same time we were doing this, we were also going to a Shivananda Yoga ashram north of Montreal, and that was a totally different scene. And that was my first experience with a different kind of faith, a more open, inclusive faith. Nobody was telling us what we had to believe. They did a lot of chanting, and one of their chants, they honored not just Shiva and Rama and Krishna, but also Moses and Jesus and Muhammad and the Buddha. And that really struck me, you know. And I remember my friend who was actually raised Muslim, and even though he left the Orthodox Islam, just as I had left the Presbyterian Church, he still had this thing about idols and, you know, only one God. And so he asked one of the swamis, because they had all these gods and goddesses, it was Hindu, you know, and he asked one of the swamis, what if you don't believe in all these gods? And the swami said, oh, that's okay. They won't do anything for you if you don't believe in them, but you don't have to believe in them. So this was a different type of faith. And then we started spending time with the Sufis, the Sufi Order International. And this was also very open and very inclusive. They have a ceremony called the Universal Worship Service, in which they honor all the spiritual traditions of the world, including the goddess tradition and native spiritualities. And it was quite beautiful. And whenever a Sufi teacher would give a talk, like a Dharma talk, but they didn't call it that. But at the end, they would say, if anything resonates with you, take it. If it doesn't, leave it, you know. So once again, a different kind of faith. And of course, that's exactly what we find in Buddhism. The Buddha says, don't believe me. Try it yourself, you know. Nobody's trying to force us into anything. This is not blind faith. This is different. And thinking about the Orthodox religions, I'm not really very interested in their doctrine, their dogma that has often been developed by committee, but I am still interested in their origins. And not really the history, because we have very little history, but I think that mythology is more true than history. History's written by the winners, right? Mythology is the stories of the human psyche. And like the human psyche, sometimes they're pretty creepy, but sometimes they're also full of wisdom. And looking back at the stories of the Christian tradition that I was raised in, what do I see? Well, I see this teacher wandering through the Holy Land with his disciples, saying things like, love your neighbor as yourself. Love your enemy. That is really radical. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. And he's saying this in occupied territory, occupied by the Roman Empire. And he's not just teaching, he's also healing. And whenever he heals somebody, what does he say? He says, your faith has made you whole. Your faith. These are not passive participants. They have to bring something to the table. And what they're bringing is their faith that somehow they can heal. Yeah. And then, okay, fast forward to a modern mythology, Star Wars. Specifically, The Empire Strikes Back. So Luke Skywalker has, he's in training to become a Jedi Knight, and he's come to the planet Dagobah to finish his training with Yoda, the Jedi Master. And the first thing he does is he dumps his spaceship in the water. He crash lands and dumps his spaceship in the pond. And so it's completely submerged, and he's fretting about it. And he says, how am I going to get it out? And so Yoda says, well, use the Force. You know, that's what you're supposed to be learning. And you can tell that Luke's a little skeptical, but finally he says, okay, I'll try. And Yoda says, not try, do. So Luke's, you know, he closes his eyes and he sticks his hand out, and we can see he's gathering his Force, and he tries to lift the spaceship, and he gets a little bit above the water, and then clunk, back in it goes. And he says, I can't. It's too big. And he goes over to the other side of the pond to sulk, basically. And so then we see the look on Yoda's face, and we can tell he's thinking, okay, I'm going to have to do this. And so he closes his eyes and sticks his hand out and gently lifts the spaceship all the way out of the water and brings it over and deposits it on dry ground. And Luke is watching this. And so he comes over and he says, I don't believe it. And Yoda says, that is why you failed. No faith. So this was a big lesson for Luke, obviously, and he did go on to become a Jedi Master. So that's, faith is the linchpin. It is the essential quality, the essential state of consciousness. And the Buddha says that faith is born out of suffering. Now, we had a discussion about this a couple of Sundays ago, I remember, because I was saying, well, you know, people generally start meditating because they're miserable. I was in Montreal, definitely. But some people said, well, no, I really didn't have that experience, you know. I had a good experience, and then I decided to start meditating. So I was thinking about that afterwards. And then I realized that path in Montreal, that was not my first experience with meditation. Back in the 70s, I had helped start a commune in Skagit County, and I was living there. And this was a pretty good time. I was not miserable. But we were doing yoga, and we were meditating a little bit at the end. And I was also reading a book about meditation. And I thought, that meditation sounds really cool. I should do this. And so I started going and sitting in the woods by myself on a log and closing my eyes and trying to meditate. I had no idea what I was doing, but it was peaceful. It was calm. And I was like beginning to feel very much a part of the forest. And if I'd had a teacher and a group, I probably would have continued. And so I'm thinking, okay, well, I wasn't miserable when I did that. So what is this all about? This faith is, you know, born out of suffering. And then suddenly it struck me, meditation is not the path. Ending suffering is the path. The Buddha says it. I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. Meditation is just part of it. 1/8, actually. So everybody, I don't think anybody would deny that everybody experiences dukkha or suffering, everyone. I mean, just being born, think about it. Getting pushed through the birth canal must be extremely uncomfortable, if not downright painful. And what do? As soon as we get our airways cleared, we cry. That's how we start this life, with suffering. So, we have these two choices. when we are in a state of suffering. We continue to go around and around, or we step into faith. And why? Why do sometimes some people step into faith? I was looking for an answer to that. It's like some kind of formula or something. And I actually asked Tim about this a couple of weeks ago when he was talking about, he mentioned faith. He was talking about the overview, but, and he was trying to, you know, he's coming up with different scenarios. Well, you've tried everything and you realize nothing is working, or you're thinking there's got to be something different. And I said, but not everybody chooses faith. And he said, no, you have to be ready, somehow ready. And finally, we just decided it's a mystery. We don't know why at some point we've had enough, right? So there are stages of faith. This kind of faith that we're talking about now, this more open, inclusive faith. Sharon Salzberg, in her book called Faith, a beautiful book, by the way, she calls this first stage of faith bright faith. And I also listened to a talk by Joseph Goldstein, and he was talking about it as more inspired faith, right? For some reason, you're inspired by a teacher or something you read or an experience or whatever, and you make that choice and you start on the path. And this is like the honeymoon stage of faith. This was like me meditating 3 hours a day, right, in Montreal. It's like you found it, right? Everything's rosy. You're going to be enlightened. But we all know honeymoons don't last. So then if you don't quit altogether, you enter the second stage, which Sharon Salzberg calls the verifying faith. Verifying faith. When you start to look at what you're doing and saying, well, is this working? You know, am I becoming freer? You know, what is happening here? And Joseph Goldstein says that at this stage of faith, this is when faith becomes the sustaining force of your practice. And he distinguishes between faith and belief, because he says belief draws conclusions. This is the way it is. We're right. You're wrong. This is what wars are fought over. I once read about two sects of the Russian Orthodox faith. One sect made the sign of the cross with two fingers and one with three fingers, and they were literally killing each other over that. So this is not that. Faith is, he says, opening up to inspiration and to remembrance. And then that brings us to the third stage of faith, which Sharon Salzberg calls abiding faith, but what I've been thinking of as faith as remembrance. Eventually, as we continue with our practice, we realize that we no longer need inspiration from outside, because we are remembering not just that the practice works, but we are remembering something deeper. We are remembering something we have always known beneath our conditioning. And that's what Joseph Goldstein calls the innate wakefulness of our own minds. If we have touched that, we begin to remember that is there, right? And as our practice matures, I think we begin to have more and more faith in the process itself. And not just the process of the practice, but the process of life. It's not that we have faith that everything will turn out always the way we want it to. It won't, okay? But we have faith that it will turn out. And I know I have often had the experience of things not turning out the way I wanted them to, and that becoming the best possible thing for me, you know, but I couldn't see it at the time. But as I look back, I can see it. And for example, okay, the end of my last marriage, my third marriage, I really resisted that marriage ending, even though I was not happy in it. It wasn't working. And I finally realized that I just couldn't face the thought of calling my parents and telling them I had screwed up another marriage. But it did end. And my husband and I had been living in this big house in Bellingham with his daughter and my two sons half time. They were with their other parents half time. And so this morning that I'm thinking about, he had moved out and his daughter. My older son was in Seattle at the University of Washington, and my younger son was at his dad's house. So I was living alone, half time, living alone for the first time in my life. I had come right from my parents to marriage, to another marriage, to another marriage, but now I was alone. And I was looking out the window at the backyard, at the garden and the fruit trees and the grape arbor and the pond, all these things that we had created and nurtured, and now they just meant nothing to me, and I did not want to be there. And as I'm thinking all of that, suddenly this thought comes: now I'm going to find out who I really am. And that thought was exciting a little bit, but it was also completely and totally terrifying. But I realized, looking back on it, that it was a statement of faith. Faith that I would learn what I needed to learn. I didn't know how long it would take to bear fruit, how long or how difficult the road would be. And it was a couple of years later when I moved to Quebec and started on my spiritual journey. And you know, it turned out to be true. I did find out who I really am. And much to my surprise, who I really am is basically nobody. Or maybe everybody. Depending on my point of view. But what a relief, right? What a relief. So now I'm thinking, what inspires my faith now? I'm definitely in the stage of faith as remembrance. I have a long history behind me. And you know, there have always been two sides to my spiritual practice, just like there are kind of two sides to my personality, I suppose. On the one hand, it's very practical, very down to earth. Is this working? I want to know this is working. I have this friend who's an astrologer. I don't know about astrology, but this is the lens through which she sees everything. And she would say, oh, that's your sun in Capricorn. I'd say, okay. But I also have this other side, which is, I always thought of it as mystical, but now Tim likes to use the word devotional, and that works too, although there is no particular object for my devotion. But this is characterized by a sense of reverence and wonder and this kind of luminous connection to everything. And my astrologer friend would say, oh, that's your moon in Pisces. Aha. And maybe, I don't know. But this type of experience I've had even before I started meditating, although meditation gave me more access to it. But I remember when I was like 13 or 14, living in Amarillo, Texas, one summer morning, it was still dark, I got my sister up and we went out. She was younger than me, still is. And we went out to the backyard. And we had this old shed, and we could get up on top of it by climbing up on a fence. So we did. We got up and we sat on the shed and it faced the east. And we watched every minute of the sunrise in complete and total silence. And I don't know what she experienced. We never talked about it. It was almost too sacred to talk about. But I disappeared into that sunrise. Yeah. And another experience I had, and this was back at the commune when I was trying to meditate in the woods and I was beginning to be so connected to the forest. One day I decided I would spend the night alone in the forest. And I took my sleeping bag and my pillow and my water, and I just spread my sleeping bag out on the ground beside this huge fallen cedar. And I remember I could hear the rustling of other creatures in the forest, but I was not afraid. And I slept really well, and I was just part of it. I was just another creature in the forest. And I woke up to first light, right? The bird song and everything. And it was again one of those experiences where I was outside of myself, right? Outside of myself. So when I think of faith as remembrance, you know, I do remember that the Dharma works on that practical side, because sometimes I don't feel like it's working, but I remember that it does. But I also remember that sense of wonder and reverence and connection. And I mean, it's not that I feel that all the time. I don't. And I can't force it. But I do know that if I get really still and really quiet and let go of myself a bit, that it is there. It is there. I have faith that it is there. So when the other day I was looking through this book of poetry by Mary Oliver, and I saw the title to a poem I had never read. And when I saw it, I thought, oh, she wrote that for me. She didn't know it, but she did. And so I want to end by sharing that with you. Sleeping in the forest. I thought the earth remembered me. She took me back so tenderly, arranging her dark skirts, her pockets full of lichens and seeds. I slept as never before, a stone on the riverbed, nothing between me and the white fire of the stars, but my thoughts, and they floated light as moths among the branches of the perfect trees. All night I heard the small kingdoms breathing around me, the insects and the birds who do their work in the darkness. All night I rose and fell, as if in water, grappling with a luminous doom. By morning, I had vanished at least a dozen times into something better. So thank you for your kind attention. Yes, anybody have questions or comments? You can raise your virtual hand down at the bottom. It says raise hand, or it might say react, and then you click on that and you can see raise hand. I just want to remind all of you that this is a safe space. If you feel at all shy about speaking up, this is a good place to do it, because nobody will hassle you. Okay? Sherry.
Thank you so much for the talk, Judith. It was really charming. Charming and penetrating also. So thank you.
Thank you.
I there was a thread of something through your talk that wasn't named, but I feel that it was there, and I'm kind of curious to hear you speak about it, and that is doubt.
Doubt.
And one of the questions that I have for myself, and that I'll pose to you and others in the group, is what is the role of doubt in our path and in relation to faith in particular?
Yeah. Well, doubt, of course, is one of the hindrances, and we all, I'm sure, experience it. Someone who was, maybe this was Goldstein, or no, maybe it was Sharon Salzberg, said that she does not think of doubt as the opposite of faith. She thinks of despair as the opposite of faith. Doubt obviously comes to everyone, but this is. Well, the nice thing about having a faith that is based on evidence is that you do begin to remember that this does work. Right? I mean, you begin to have evidence that it does work. Despair is harder to get out of, I think. And obviously, doubt is what I left the Presbyterian Church over, right? Because they couldn't answer my questions, and because I had no evidence, right? So it just wasn't making sense. So what do you think? I'd be interested to hear what you think. What's your experience with doubt?
I think you're directing that question to me, so I'm jumping on again.
Yeah, I am.
I think that it is interwoven, like in the stories that you told about yourself and about Luke Skywalker. I don't know that Luke could have shown up, landed, and then believe, I'm going to use the word believed. Like it has a little bit the quality of like, I believe. It's like, it's too much of a leap. I feel like doubt is kind of like this, interwoven process with developing faith or openness somehow. And, yeah, maybe that's the Jewish background for me. The questioning is part of the practice.
Oh, I think it is, yeah.
So
Absolutely.
I'm still really feeling this out a lot for myself, so thanks
Yeah,
for
and I think in the case of Luke, for example, yeah, I think it was too big a leap. He had to see Yoda do it. And then he knew it was possible. That was part of the lesson, right? And we also have teachers, we also have people who are ahead of us that we can look at and say, oh, okay, maybe they did it. Yeah. But I agree. I think it is part of the practice. Yeah. Okay, Lyndall.
Okay, I'm unmuted.
Yes, you
I didn't
are.
try to talk first. Well, since this subject of doubt has come up, I'll say a little bit about that. Well, maybe it's a little bit of both, but for me, I think there's kind of two aspects of doubt. There's a one part of it that is just that not understanding something or not knowing about something. And for me, that part of doubt, that isn't such a big hindrance or an obstacle. That because that's something you can ask about it, you can read about it, you can find out about it. I mean, it only becomes an obstacle when you get this feeling that you've got to know or everything falls apart. Mm-hmm. The biggest issue for me has been this sort of more doubt in myself that mm-hmm. I can't do this, that I'm not worthy, you know, that kind of feeling. And that's the feeling that I think has been the biggest issue in my practice. But one thing I've found as I've gone along is that, you know, that sense of the sort of abiding faith, a lot of it has to do with being okay with not knowing. I mean, it's sort of what you're saying, being okay with moving into a mystery.
Yeah.
And having a sense that, yeah, okay, I don't really understand this, but
yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it.
Yeah, it's a huge part of it.
The huge part, yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Great talk. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Okay, Candace.
I loved your talk. Just loved it. I knew I was going to, but I just loved it. And I loved your bringing up Yoda and Luke Skywalker. I have a really strong relationship with doubt versus despair.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like doubt. Doubt gets me thinking. It gets me engaged. It gets me energized. I go, well, okay, let's look into this. But despair, and I was realizing recently that I have a friend that we're both writers and we email each other every day. And I was noticing how often I mention the word, I despair about what's going on in the country, because he's in England. And I thought, I really started pulling out a lot of my stuff, my readings about faith and about joy, awakening joy, and the importance of beauty and the importance of... So I realized that I needed my faith in the beauty in the world and how important that is, what gives us resilience. That is what shows us what we're fighting for, what we're standing up for. And that I had forgotten that Sharon said that faith and despair, but the moment you mentioned that, I could see where in the book she says that. It's just like, yes. And doubt is kind of the juicy one. It doesn't, I know it's a hindrance, and I know that in certain cases it is, but for me, most of the time, doubt is just like, okay, let's figure this out.
Yeah.
Let's see what's going on here. And despair is the dark one.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I get that too. Because that's when you start asking questions, and that's when the Orthodox doctrine does not want those questions.
Exactly.
But these more open spiritual paths do. They welcome it.
Yeah.
They welcome it. And that's why it's a very different kind of faith.
Yeah, and I loved what Suze talked about a couple weeks ago, that in the Orthodox religions, there are questions that are forbidden.
Yeah.
Not supposed to ask those questions, and I certainly came up against a lot of that in high school when I lost my faith in the Catholic Church. This openness is just so inspiring.
It is, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lauren.
Well, I wasn't sure what I was going to say, but I just really liked that that opposite thing that Sharon said, the despair, not doubt. So that caught me, and I wanted to explore that. And then when Sherry mentioned doubt, I thought that's really something to explore. So I guess what first I'll say that I feel when you give a talk that we're sitting around a campfire and they're telling us a story and we're all kind of, you know, just waiting for the next the next thing. It's really fun to listen to you, and of course the content is really great too. So I was thinking about faith in that, that I didn't grow up with a dogma. I didn't grow up in a church, so I never rebelled against faith because I didn't have a doctrine to rebel against, but I was always interested mm-hmm. in faith and religion. And so for me, there's a felt sense that if I'm on that path inside, there's a faith, you know, that is the right path. You know, there's something in me, but it's an unknown. So it's like kind of faith in the unknown. And it's not even, I really enjoyed Rodney's weekend retreat because he talked about the unknown is what it is. We can't know it. And so that kind of gives me more faith in faith. And because that's what I sense inside. Mm-hmm. And then the doubt I have is very much like what Lyndall said, that I have doubt that I can do it. Mm-hmm. And I've been looking at that, and I've been seeing that doubt next to my faith, you know, like in my body at the same time, and seeing that that doubt is definitely part of the ego, you know, it's mm-hmm. So the other thing that Rodney said is that we need to be able to know both at the same time, to see how they, to sense how they work together. Right. So that's something that I've really been trying to get, the felt sense of faith that I know is inside, is what you were talking about, Judith, that's there, that I can't articulate, but know, and the doubt that's there also at the same time, and how those kind of are part of the movement of my life. And I'm trying to actually meditate with those senses to know them mm-hmm. better.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you. I loved, I got a lot from your talk and the responses to your talk too.
Thank you. Yeah, thinking about, you know, looking for a formula, like why does some people step into faith and some people don't, and trying to get Tim to come up with a formula, and finally just saying, oh, it's a mystery. It's a mystery. Some things we don't know. Yeah. Okay, Carolyn.
Thank you, Judith, for your very personal sharing and your talk. I was thinking a lot about this. I similarly didn't really grow up with a very traditional religious background, but in Christianity, and I had some of the same questions that you had. You know, I was like, this doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make any sense. Those exact questions really struck home when you were talking, because they're the same questions that I had. And this is kind of, I was exploring this in high school. And then I was thinking, this is a question for everyone, because I found that, you know, when I first started practicing, I was very inspired, like you said, like just this, oh my gosh, it's like, so much faith comes into you, and it's so powerful, and it's such a strong feeling, and you really start to see how the practice can transform you in your life. Mm-hmm. And then as I continue to practice, I've seen the hindrances come up too. And I feel it's like, it's almost like, I don't know if this is right or not, but could it be like you're working on a purification process of your own self? And working on your ego, like letting go of the ego, or allaying like your own greed, hatred, and aversion, because every human being has them within themselves. And so I find, though, when I confront those things in myself, like I see my own greed or my own desire, like it makes me sad to see it there. But I recognize it when I see it, and I'm like, oh, that's what this is, you know? And I think also just when you recognize that and you realize like, oh, we all have this, like we all have to work on this. Like this is a part of being human. We have this shadow self and we have this beautiful light and the two are there together and they're in this balancing act. And it's when you fail to see those characteristics coming up. Like maybe they're hindrances, but also maybe they're teachers, I guess is what I'm saying. So I'm working with that right now, but sometimes, my gosh, something will come up and I'm like, yuck, why did that come into my mind? Like, no, I just want to take some soap and pour it in.
Right. Oh, I know that feeling so well.
I'm like, why did that come to me at this time?
And I know. It's like this. What that horrible thought. I've been meditating for 35 years. Why am I having that?
Why
horrible
did this
thought,
happen?
You know?
Yeah. And then I'm learning though, like instead of like trying to push it away or say like, oh, you're terrible, you know, instead I'm like, oh, this is human, you know, just let it go. Yeah. And maybe don't chase after it, I guess is what I'm trying to do. Just let it go. And then keep working on, you know, the seeds of goodness, the seeds of kindness, compassion, equanimity, all those good things that we know we want to foster within ourselves to be better human beings. But it's interesting because in the beginning, I really didn't have either the hindrances were not there or they weren't very strong. And like as time went on, I'm like, oh, okay, I have to deal with these things. So anyway, I just was curious how others deal with the hindrances when they come up or when doubt comes up, what do you do? Like, what is your approach?
Yeah, I think that that's a very good point. And, you know, it's like I'm saying the honeymoon stage is so wonderful, feels so wonderful, but we are going deeper and we are going deeper into ourselves and we are uncovering things for sure, you know, our defenses are crumbling. And sometimes it just feels like a slog, you know? But then, you know, I didn't stop. I never stopped. It's like, what's the alternative? To go back and totally be caught in it? No, that's not an alternative. So yeah, I think there, and many people, many, many teachers have talked about that, how it seems to get harder sometimes, but maybe it's actually accomplishing more too, you know. Yeah. Thank you. Justin.
Hey, yeah. This has been a great conversation. Thanks, Judith, for everything you've shared. I can definitely relate as a young person who was sort of like brought into some some Christianity early on and a lot of that. And I remember asking, you know, my sister who was sort of bringing me into that world, like, what about people who are, you know, like grow up in the rainforest and they have no idea what's going on? Like, why are they punished? You know, just like, wow, this is crazy. So I really resonated with that. And this conversation about, you know, doubt and faith and belief reminds me of one of the first books I read that kind of brought me into, you know, thinking about Buddhism and meditation and everything was Buddhism Without Belief by Stephen Batchelor. And I really appreciated that book for articulating the kind of value of not being set in a certain belief or way and the kind of value of a sort of agnosticism and the truth that that captures, that there is a whole lot that we can't really know. And so being okay with that is just being okay with what's real, which I think is great. And, you know, I think like thinking about doubt, I think it kind of keeps us honest. And I think it becomes a hang up when we believe in our doubt really like too much, you know, and then that becomes this thing that we're stuck to. Like Caroline, you were just kind of saying the, you know, pushing it away or holding on to it. And then it becomes sort of this hindrance and, you know, but at other times it just keeps us grounded in what's real, which is that we don't really know. So it makes sense to be doubtful, you know, but you just kind of keep coming back and starting again and seeing what feels right.
Yeah. One thing, I have a son who meditates as well. And one thing he keeps telling his son, my grandson, is don't believe everything you think. And that comes to me often, you know, like when I'm, oh my God, how did I do this? And then I think, oh, don't believe everything you think. This is just a thought. That's all. It's nothing, right? Listen to it. See it. But I don't have to believe it. Okay, Suze. And I think you're the last one here.
Okay, thanks. Carolyn, you asked such a good question. I thought everybody's sharing has been wonderful. And I wanted to share how I also, it took some years for the hindrances to be just really like right there in my face. And I think what, as I've reflected on it, I think it was because I was so deluded that I didn't notice the aversion and the clinging and being a high energy, active person. I thought restlessness was just the nature. And I didn't even notice that, you know, there's a way that meditation could be unrestless. It could be easeful. So for me, the hindrances became more alive the more I practiced, because then I started questioning, oh, what's actually here right now? And then the teachings helped me put some words and understanding to it. But anyway, I wanted to respond to your question about that, because I had a similar experience that they showed up strong and later.
Yeah, that I'd say that's true for me too. And I think it is, as we're saying, we're uncovering. And becoming less deluded, more honest with ourselves, and then we see, oh yeah, okay, there it is. Yeah. But then we don't have to, you don't have to buy that that's who we really are, right? We see it for what it is. And I like Rodney saying, you don't have to have a commentary, you know, see what has arisen and just see it. That's all you have to do. You don't have to keep commenting on it, because you're just creating more nonsense, right? Yeah. Anyway, it's time for us to go, but thank you all so much. I so enjoy hearing your wisdom. I so appreciate that. Yeah. So
thank you, Judith. Have a good
Thanks,
week, Sandra.
Everybody.
Thank you, Judith.
Yeah.
Bye,
go
Seahawks.
Bye.
Go Seahawks.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Judith.